Hello and welcome to the Leaders in Supply Chain podcast. I am your host, Radu Palamariu, Managing Director of Elkett Global. Our mission is to connect the supply chain ecosystem globally by bringing forward the most interesting leaders in the industry. And it's my pleasure to have with us today Vikram Agarwal, who is the President and Chief Supply Chain Officer of Avon. Vikram is a seasoned supply chain professional with a career spanning 30 years in the industry. He is responsible for leading the continued rollout of Avon's new supply chain transformation plan, aimed at delivering improved service and significant savings to fuel the company's growth. Since joining Avon in early 2019, Vikram has successfully overhauled the company's customer and representative proposition, service offering, functional processes, and cost management. This part of the business touches more than 10,000 associates in the supply chain function, as well as Avon's footprint of in more than 50 countries globally, 8 manufacturing sites, and 50 distribution centers. Vikram joined Avon from Unilever, where he served as Executive Vice President, Supply Chain Africa, and was responsible for a multi-billion dollar regional business, including end-to-end supply chain across 15 countries, 14 factories, and 25,000 employees. And prior to this, he was also Group Vice President, Global Home Care Supply Chain at Unilever, where he was responsible for direct business planning with country and regional leadership. Vikram, thank you for taking the time and joining us today.
Thank you. Glad to be here, Radu.
Super. So let's start a little bit, in terms of the business model, because Avon obviously is quite a different type of a business. You have 10,000 associates that basically help you sell and distribute your products. How is managing Avon supply chain operations different in this respect from Unilever? And how is it similar? Maybe let's start there.
So I think the first thing is that if I just step back and look at conceptually at how Avon is organized compared to other consumer goods or maybe beauty products companies, is that the channel is largely owned by us through our representatives who are not our associates, but certainly they represent us. And that's a force of, if you like, millions of sales people in our sales force around the world. So on one hand, we are a channel owner, like the retailers maybe. On the other hand, we are a branded goods company like any other beauty branded goods company maybe. So I think the unique thing about Avon, it brings this front end and the back end together in a sort of convergent model, which if you look at it, very few companies around the world are in that space. Either you find the retailers or you find the FMCG companies, as you said, but very few who are encompassing both. Now that brings in the supply chain its own challenges, because that customer base of millions of representatives is also always churning. Unlike a FMCG company where you can say that the customer base is largely static. So when you look at, just as an example, at forecasting, it adds another variable in the forecasting process, which is about the number of representatives you have in a particular area or region or city or country. And you have to factor that in as you plan to give your service, because that becomes a very important input variable into your demand forecasting. In addition, this is not about serving the warehouses of a large modern trade retailer in Europe. This is about making the boxes reach people's homes. So this is about making sure that each one of the millions of representatives, when they place an order in a campaign, and a campaign typically lasts 3 weeks. So every campaign, every 3 weeks, you've got millions of representatives around the world placing their orders of maybe $20, $30, $40 equivalent, consisting of 20 to 30 units. And each box has to be absolutely perfect in terms of the accuracy of the items that they have ordered and the address to which it is delivered and on the time it is delivered. So in essence, Avon is around delivering boxes to the customer's homes, whereas any other large FMCG company would be about delivering a truck or part of a truck to a customer. And that's what really brings the complexity. That's what shifts the node in Avon's supply chain operation to really the pick and pack operations that we have rather than any other back-end operations. If you don't get that one right, this sort of a business can never succeed. Yeah. And vice versa, if you can get that right, then that is what you can really build as a competitive advantage. Yeah. So really, I believe that the competitive advantage on the model of this company is our ability to deliver that box accurately to the customer again and again, every 3 weeks in every part of the world.
And obviously the brand has been there for 130 years. So for sure, there's a high level of success. And I wanted to bring the discussion a little bit to the transformation project that you've been having for the last couple of months, and I think it started last year with the open up strategy and the focus on digital transformation. And you picked it up when you joined on the 2019, and you started with Avon. But I was curious, because digital transformation is kind of like the buzzword, right? Or it used to be, or it still is. But you're already seeing some results and some notable projects coming to fruition within Avon. And maybe you can give us an example or two in terms of specifically in the supply chain world, what you've done and what are some of the results that you are getting.
Yeah, so I think the first thing which we identified needs to be done is, I would put it loosely under the banner of simplification, making ourselves simpler and leaner. Now, what that means is, I think we have got far too many SKUs. We had too many SKUs. We have reduced about 25% of our SKU count in the last, since the beginning of this year. But I think we still have too many, and we have got a large way to go over there. And the reason for that is, once again, the business model. We have around one third of our SKUs being churned around every year as newness or innovations. Now, you need to be careful that when you're doing that kind of an innovation churn, that you have an absolute religion around one in, one out. Otherwise, you can make your portfolio absolutely too complex for anybody to comprehend on the sales side as to what they should sell and how. So the first part is around simplifying our portfolio, reducing our SKU count. As I said, that we have successfully reduced it by about 25% in the past 8 months. The second one is around making the whole supply chain much leaner. And as soon as me and my colleagues think of a lean supply chain, the first thing to where our mind goes is inventory. More the inventory you have, less, more of a lag do you have in introducing newness, because you've got a pipeline over there which you need to exhaust before anything you can come in. And more the risk you run of hurting the P&L through write-offs and so on. So I think the first thing which one does in order to make the supply chain more agile is to bring the inventory onto a level which is optimum. It can still drive service, and at the same time, it's something which is fast moving. The trick is not about having a large inventory. The trick is about having the right inventory. So in the past 1 year or so, we have managed to reduce our inventory by around 20% of where it was, but at the same time, we have also improved our service by almost 800 basis points. So really, the myth that larger inventory means better service does not really stand. Right inventory means better service rather than a large inventory. So that's the second part of simplification. And the third part of simplification, again in the supply chain, is about having a lean footprint. Yeah. One needs to be absolutely sure that which are the assets in the supply chain which have a strategic merit, either on account of the geography, the country where they're located, or the technology, or the scale, whatever the criteria may be. But one needs to constantly keep evaluating what is really strategic in terms of the competitive edge which your supply chain has, and what is non-strategic. And constantly, there needs to be a process of simplifying this and keeping to yourself what is really important and letting others do what is not so strategic. Yeah. And there are enough high-class service providers in the world, be it contract manufacturers, be it planning experts, so on, who can do that job for you in as efficient a manner as you can, as long as you're not dealing with proprietary technology or a geographical strategic advantage. Yeah. So that's about simplification. Yeah. I think besides that, if I just zoom back to the open up strategy, it is also about, I would call it very simply, that making sure everything is available everywhere and every time to a consumer when she wants it. Now, when I say every time, an example of this is that we have always operated on what we call a mail plan, which means a representative can order only once during a given campaign of 3 weeks and her order will be delivered. Now, we have been working on unconstraining that, and we've been saying that you can order it anytime. So you don't need to just place an order once in a campaign on a particular day or a particular week. Order anytime and we will deliver anytime. And in fact, we have increased our what we call out of mail plan access by 50%. It's gone up by 1.5 times to where it stood in 2018. The second part is everywhere. And this is about saying that we will deliver to the last consumer in her home if she wants it. In a number of cases, it's the sales leaders who wanted to deliver themselves or the representatives wanted to be delivered. Fine. But we need to give that optionality to the customer that how does she want the delivery to happen. And I'll come back on that, why I'm saying that, why that is so important. But let me finish with the third one, which is everything. Now, in a portfolio which is as complex with a huge number of SKUs, it is important that as far as the customer is concerned, every box she receives is complete. So we call it shorts. And what we have successfully launched internally, we call it a war on shorts, is that we may be saying that there is only one SKU out of 4,000 in a given country which is run short. But try telling that to a representative who has received one shot out of 12 items which he had ordered. So I think it's very important that we get this right and we deliver every single item in time. No different than the time-tested principles of what we call in service as on time in full. Essentially, it's a exploded version of that because we are dealing directly with so many customers. Yeah. So that's what I would have in terms of how we are opening up strategy. Maybe just one more point is that in addition, and maybe it fits in as a part of everywhere, is that we are now starting to develop business models for delivering to the customers, even in countries where we do not have a direct selling presence, meaning we do not have reps in that country, but still we have customers who are interested in getting our products because there is a very strong brand awareness, or maybe because historically Avon used to do business in that country. So we are evolving business models to really make sure that this sort of an offshore trade can still help us make our products reach those customers. I said I will come back to everywhere and about making the deliveries to the customers directly at their choice. At the heart of that is an intent to make sure that our representatives are not carriers of boxes. They're not couriers. They're really beauty advisors. We want to value add to the proposition of the representative, where her role is not just about ordering a box on behalf of her customers, us delivering a box to her, and then she carrying the individual items to the customers who had ordered it in the first place. We can do that. We can do that more effectively than her and more effortlessly than her. So therefore, why make the representative do it? And if she so chooses, we would be happy to deliver the box to her customers rather than to her. So that the legwork, the physical effort out of that is taken out, and she focuses more on being a beauty advisor, properly trained as a consultant, if you like, who can go and tell people which products are good for them and how. So really, that's to me, from a supply chain lens, is what open up means. Yeah, simplify and then deliver everything, everywhere, every time.
Mm. No, but it's a huge shift, and it's paradigm shift. The second part is obviously, if the representative no longer has to or has the option of not delivering, I think it takes a lot of hassle away. At the same time, that's a huge challenge for the supply chain of Avon to implement, and I imagine that you've gone through quite a bit of challenges to get there, and I'm sure that you're probably still in the journey. And I wanted to touch a little bit also on the ever-increasing expectations of customers, of the end customer, that the delivery gets to them faster and faster, right? Because in the e-commerce world, you have next day, you have 1 hour, you have benchmarks that are getting smaller and smaller, driven by Amazon and all the, you know, Alibabas of the world. How do you, and what's your kind of, you know, benchmark as well as strategy, right, in terms of fulfillment last mile to keep pushing those, you know, the envelope faster and faster to make sure that your clients and customers get the products fast?
Yeah, I think the first thing is, you rightly called it out, is that the expectation of the customer today is that if she places an order online, let us say, then the SKU, the product should be reaching her as soon as possible. Because remember, in her mind, she is exercising an option to order online rather than walk to the nearest brick and mortar retail store and buy it from there. And she needs to be absolutely satisfied with the option that she has taken of ordering it online compared to having walked into a store and picked up the item. And therefore, if the online ordering system like ours does not deliver in time, if it is not prompt, if it is not responsive, then obviously we will adversely affect the choice. So I think if I just look at the numbers, I must first of all say that we are not where we would want to be in this aspect, but it has been improving. Between 2018 and 19, we would be shrinking our average delivery time by 2 days. So we used to be 6 days on the average globally. And I do hope that this year we'll be achieving 4 days. So that's 30% of delivery time improvement, if you like to put it that way. But within that, I think it is important to look at options which give same day delivery or 4 hours delivery or 1 hour delivery, depending on what the expectation of your consumers is over there. So while you have this overall picture of reduction in the number of days, but within that, we have also introduced express services. For example, we have a 1 hour delivery pilot, which is now operational in Brazil and Colombia, which if an online order is placed, within 1 hour, we can have the product directly at the doorstep of the consumer. And this is working in, as I said, in Brazil, which is one of our biggest beauty markets around the world. But in addition to that, we have also piloted, let's say, a 4 hour delivery in one of the metros in India. In UK, we have had a 24-hour express service model, which traditionally has had its challenges. We have revamped the complete model, and now at least we can say that it will be a 12-hour delivery. And having set the systems and having set the mechanism for that delivery in place, I'm sure we can now keep on pushing that line further and saying, how can 12 hours come to 8 hours or 4 hours and so on. So there are solutions. There are solutions which are available out in the market. You can either set up that capability yourself, or you can go to somebody else to provide it. But it's not straightforward, and it's not easy for somebody who's manufacturing and distributing their products, because it has to get integrated with the way that you manufacture products in your factory. There has to be sufficient flexibility over there. It has to have its way into how you plan for your demand and therefore supply to it. What do you keep in your warehouses and what you don't? How far your warehouse should be from the consumer? And maybe you need even more warehouses or distribution centers than we have. How efficient is your pick and pack capability? So it has when you start with an ambition of the same day delivery or a few hours delivery, it's not just about putting a truck or a van and making it run around to the consumers where you want to, whom you want to deliver promptly. It has an implication on the entire upstream supply chain, as I described.
And I'd love to, because 1 hour delivery in Brazil to me is mind-boggling. I mean, it's just like it's an incredible achievement. And I think we should stress it to the listeners, because maybe not everybody knows. And I mean, I am aware that, and some people are aware of the footprint that you have, which is amazing in Brazil, and is probably one of your largest market, if not the largest. But still, 1 hour delivery is enormously fast or is incredibly fast. So maybe let's go a little bit into that particular one. And I'd love maybe to, if you can share some insights into how did you get there? I mean, you know, because also, I mean, I imagine before it maybe one day or a few days, what was the process of thinking it? What were some of the things that you did? Maybe some lessons, you know, some practical, if somebody was listening to this podcast and wanted to take something practical away from, you know, from this major achievement of delivering within 1 hour using your own kind of network, how did you do it?
So I think first thing was a realization we cannot do it alone. And we entered into a partnership with a company, which is a local delivery company with approximately 1 million subscribers in Brazil alone. So therefore, it's not just our products. If we had tried to set it up in our products, the cost to serve would have been astronomical because we would not have had a scale to carry off an operation like this on our own. So therefore, we had to get into a partnership with somebody who's used to doing it, not in our industry, but in other industries. And therefore, they have the lanes, they have the reach, they have the network, which is already optimized for the total scale which they carry. The second part is that this is an operation which you cannot do in a large country like Brazil, everywhere and to everyone. One has to segment the representatives and say that which are the ones from whom you can really get value out of this. So it can't be somebody who places an order once in a year because she's not really concerned about whether the product is reaching her directly, and she may be a consumer herself rather than a seller of the product, which means that she doesn't have a promise of delivery to be met downstream in the sales chain. So rep segmentation, who receives this service, is another angle. And the third is about where do we do it? Although I said Brazil, but where we have so far piloted it is in the metros, because Brazil is a huge country. And I would be imagining if I said that it can be done anywhere inside Brazil, but where we have been able to do it is in metros. So I would say that so first is a partnership. Second is a segmentation of your customer population, and maybe combined with a segmentation of some of our product portfolio also. Yeah, because some of the things like color cosmetics can be delivered instantaneously, and some others people may be prepared to wait for it. So segmentation, which is the second one, and about being very focused on the centers and the geographies where you're offering this service. Because, you know, once you advertise this service, it's a promise. And then a customer would measure you against that. And you better be sure when you are promising this that you will be able to deliver to it.
Absolutely. I mean, customer satisfaction is key. And if you were to think now in terms of, and I'm sure that you're already thinking, and you mentioned a couple of examples as in, you know, in high density areas in India or in UK, what would be your steps in terms of other markets, right? How would you decide, okay, let's shorten our durations in this particular market, because you're present in 50 countries, right? So I'm assuming, is there like a hierarchy of, okay, because we have, it's usually based on volume of business or density of business, how would you make the decision, okay, let's go into shortening these durations for delivery in this country versus that country versus this country?
Yeah, I think one of the barometers for that would be how well penetrated is e-commerce in that country. Because more the penetration of e-commerce, more the customer expectation of a quick and prompt delivery. Yeah. So that's the first criteria which I would use, is that how strong is the customer expectation? Because there is a cost attached to it. And therefore, are the customers prepared to pay for this kind of a service? Does it really matter to them to an extent that you can charge a dollar more or whatever in every delivery? Yeah. So that would be the first barometer which I would use to judge this. The second one would, of course, be the practicality and being able to do it. Which are the cities where you can really offer this promise and live up to it? If you try to offer it in, just for an example, the eastern part of Russia, then probably you will never get there. You'll probably never be able to fulfill the promise. Yeah. And the third is, very loosely speaking, is this expectation is much more prevalent in the developed countries. So I would say that geographically speaking, I would look at either our big businesses like Brazil, which I mentioned, or I would look at Europe, where the customer really wants this and they are used to this kind of a service. So they are overlapping criteria. I would say the penetration of e-commerce, which I said first, then the stage of development of the country in terms of its economic development, and the size of our business, and where can we really achieve it practically speaking and where we cannot. I would even want to introduce this kind of a service if I had even a 10% probability of not being able to meet it.
Yes. Mm. And maybe let's discuss a little bit the challenges that you're facing in the different markets, because you sit and you have a global position being the chief supply chain officer, and you have very good visibility in the different markets, and you have Latin America, which is very large for you. I think it's about 60% of the business I was reading. You have Europe, you have Asia, you have... You have Africa as well, right? I think South Africa, yes. there's some part. So maybe we can, I think North America, you divested that business. So maybe you can tell us among these four regions, Latin America, Europe, Africa, Asia, what would be certain challenges maybe specific to each, and a little bit on how you're addressing it.
Yeah, so let me take Europe first. Europe is all about a good product, high rate of innovation, and outstanding service. So it's about making sure that your operations are as efficient as they can be, even if it comes at a cost, because there is the ability to charge a price for this. Yeah. So Europe is about perfection, if I put it simply that way. It's about supply chain perfection. It's about having outstanding products and delivering them outstandingly. Asia is more about... Well, Asia, I would also maybe cut it up into a country where we have a strong business, which is Philippines. And in the Philippines, I would just look at making sure that we keep expanding our geographical footprint, keep opening more and more stores, because that is the model over there, where the reps come to shop, and run a very efficient supply chain with very affordable products. So affordability and reach would be the key to grow our business in Philippines. Now, if I look at the two big growth engines of the world, not just for us, which is for everybody, which is China and India, and they indeed are our defined growth engines, that is about growing a business from a very, very small size, given the magnitude of these countries, into something which is really meaningful and which has got scale. So it's and that can come through a combination of factors. Usually, it is about geography and putting, developing more representatives in wider areas of the country, so that we have more channels, we have a greater customer network, and so on. So therefore, India and China as the growth engines are about increasing the size of the front end and having the supply chain capability to deliver to them, again, at an affordable cost. You'll see that the affordability theme is something which runs all across Asia and Africa. Whereas if I look at developed markets like Europe, like what I already said, it is the rate of innovation and your ability to land newness with speed, which starts mattering more. If I come to Africa, which is a very, very interesting proposition, because our African business is largely centered around South Africa. And the whole sub-Saharan Africa is there to really be able to penetrate and make our products reach over there effectively. And all the more, it has an even greater focus on affordability than the other markets which I talked about. So Africa is all about being able to put a good affordable product on wheels and making it reach the last customer who wants it. So therefore, it's a slightly different nuance going all around. Yeah, and Latin America, I would say that Brazil is closer to the way that we would operate in Europe, whereas the rest of the countries, Brazil and Mexico, are closer to the European supply chain philosophy, whereas the other countries, Colombia and the Southern Cone, they are closer to the Asian philosophy, like the Philippines one, which I described. So there are always nuances that for the developed market, you focus on efficiency, service, newness, a churn of innovations. And for the developing markets, you focus on increase of your reach, a broader network while keeping your affordability of products in check.
And this question just came fresh into my mind, and I was just curious because on one side you have different markets and different needs for each of the markets. On the other side, I'm sure that there's global initiatives, and it might be from a technology perspective, it might be from a systems perspective, it might be from an integration perspective. Would there be certain tools or certain specific platforms, or I mean, you don't necessarily need to name them in particular, but I'm just curious, for even as a global brand, would there be something that globally you implemented and rolled out in the different sub-regions or continents, and it made a lot of impact in the supply chain operation?
I think one thing which I would call out is machine learning and demand forecasting, particularly in the European markets, where we have deployed a tool which was built in-house, which is, let's say, an artificial intelligence tool for fine-tuning your demand plan, demand forecast, campaign after campaign. So it learns based on the previous sales that you've done. And it's a very complex algorithm which runs behind the engine, which primarily looks at all kinds of factors, you know, the weather, the economic situation of a town, and so on and so forth. And you factor all of that in, and you get an output over there, which is reasonably accurate. Now, when we started with this tool a few months ago, we were getting results which were, I would say, a complete disaster. But that is the very nature of the tool, is that campaign after campaign, it learns and it starts becoming more and more accurate. So I think that is a tool which we have already started, which we have rolled out in four markets around the world. And that's one thing which I'm quite confident that very soon we'll be able to roll it out globally. Yeah. We need to, of course, be careful because, you know, while it is a tool which learns itself, but as I described to you, the diversity of the markets, there are always nuances on how you run it and how you operate it. How trained are your people? How people understand the input and the output of the tool? Because any artificial intelligence tool can very soon fall prey to what they call garbage in and garbage out. Yeah. So you need to be careful of the quality of the inputs that you're able to provide into it also. So I think that is one global tool that we are putting in place. And my commercial colleagues are also now putting in a similar tool, but different, but also based on artificial intelligence in being able to project the number of representatives, new and old, and the revenue per representative that we are likely to see on the demand coming in. So if you combine these two, one is predicting that important variable of number of representatives, and the second one is predicting the demand per representative. And if you combine that, then you come to a reasonably or progressively more accurate demand forecast.
Yes. And in terms of the... I wanted to ask you the question from a perspective of let's say, medium-sized manufacturer within FMCG or cosmetics or similar industries, because Avon is a big brand, and before that you were with Unilever. These brands and these companies are built over many, many years, and they have big budgets. But let's say you were put in a position where you were leading the supply chain function in a smaller company that may not have the same type of budgets as Avon has. What would be some of the low-hanging fruits you would focus on first to optimize your supply chain in today's world?
Yeah, I can assure you I don't have a big budget.
Yeah, maybe I didn't frame the question properly, but yeah.
Yes, but I think coming to your question, there are two or three things which come to my mind. First is that any medium scale or a smaller enterprise needs to keep its fixed cost as low as possible, even if it comes at the cost of higher variable cost. One can always increase the fixed cost by investing more capital, for example, building your own factory or owning a warehouse or something. But the starting point as you're trying to expand is to keep those fixed costs low. The second I would say is about keeping the portfolio very sharp and very targeted. And there needs to be a very good understanding of good complexity and bad complexity in the business. For example, having 10 types of fragrances in offer may actually be a good thing because it is subjective and the consumers have preferences and they may choose one over the other. Same thing about colors in a lipstick or on a nail varnish, for instance. But there may be other complexity, for example, in creams. Yeah, you may not need as much complexity as you would in the other two examples which I quoted. So I would say for a company which is smaller, it is extremely important to keep the portfolio focused with the right consumer insights on what is good complexity and what is not so good complexity. So fixed cost, complexity of the portfolio. And the third thing which I would call out is, if I were in that position, I would not hesitate to develop more and more partnerships in the areas of distribution, logistics, even manufacturing through contract manufacturers and so on, just to leverage the greater scale of somebody else. Ultimately, in the supply chain, whether you should go on your own or you should go in collaboration or partnership with somebody is a function of whether the other person can create more scale across different customers or you can create more scale across your entire portfolio. Yeah. The same applies to buying. So therefore, I'm a strong believer in strategic partnerships, be it across maybe outsourced operations, be it across buying, be it across manufacturing, be it across distribution. So that's the third element which I would bring into it, to not hesitate to develop some bold partnerships in supply chain areas.
And that's an excellent point. It brings to my mind an example of one of our clients is in the appliances industry, and basically I won't name them, but for simplicity's sake, I'll just say that they acquired a company that had in the range of 150 staff, and they were making us two or three appliances for the kitchen. That's all they were making, two or three, but really, really innovative products, and all the stuff that those guys had were around 150, 200 staff, because they mostly only did the R&D side and a little bit on the marketing side, but even that was mostly outsourced. The contract manufacturing, it was done through, the product was manufactured through contract manufacturing. Logistics were outsourced. Everything was, so basically they bare-boned the business only to the unique selling proposition, which was the patents, the R&D development, and the company bought them over so that they can learn from them how to transform, the company was a bigger conglomerate, how to transform themselves. So that kind of goes with your very well with your point of, build partnerships wherever you can, keep the core, keep what's unique and keep what's your added value and advantage to the market. But other than that, if you can outsource or you can work with partners, that's easier.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think without naming it, I can guess the company which you're talking about. And if I'm right on my guess, this company has grown by 200% in the last 5 years.
Yeah, or more. Yeah, something like that. So, yeah, we'll share separately. But I wanted also to bring the discussion to the talent and human resources side, and the supply chain function is a function of people, like all companies actually, and all functions at the end of the day. I'd love to get your thoughts also in terms of attracting people and attracting the right talent and skill set to the supply chain world, which is like all the other functions changing, and there's a lot of transformation going on. How do you in particular manage to attract the right type of talent in your team and the right type of skills as well? Because also the skill set is kind of blending now. You have the technical, the core supply chain skills, the digital skills, the technology types of skill sets. How do you keep this mix well and balanced in the team?
See, I think first of all, for me, whenever hiring any new talent, the top line is, does the person have the business acumen? Because the days when supply chain could operate as a silo are, to my mind, no longer there. Supply chain people have to be businessmen. If you look at the three imperatives of supply chain, as I always keep saying, it is service, and that is about growth. It is costs, and that is about profitability. And it is working capital and capex, which is about cash. And really, if you connect these three imperatives of the supply chain with the three imperatives of any business, which is growth, profitability, and cash flow, we are not doing anything in the supply chain which is different from what the business is doing. And if we are doing something which is supply chain for the sake of supply chain, I think we should stop it. But if it is not aligned with any of the business imperatives. So therefore, in terms of talent, my first and foremost criteria for anybody who's joining the supply chain is to ask the person a question, show me how are you a business leader? If you were theoretically being asked to run the business in a particular country with full P&L responsibility, do you have what it takes to be able to run it? Yeah. So that's maybe I'm saying it a little differently than what my supply chain colleagues have been used to, or I have been used to myself in the past. But really, in this world, with all the connectivity, with all the growth criteria, with all the boom and bust of companies coming in and companies going out, unless in the supply chain we behave as true businessmen, we will not be able to understand what we can do within the supply chain. Yeah, and that immediately introduces values like entrepreneurship, practical creativity, partnering the business and being an enabler, rather than, as one often hears the word, it's a supply chain constraint. I hate that phrase when it comes to me. It said, why am I a constraint? How can I change that? So that's the first one about being a businessman. And the second one is not to forget is that supply chain is an area which requires skills. It requires skills to understand how an S&OP process should be working, how demand planning should be done, how APO should be run, what can you do in a back office, what do you need to do in the front of the markets, how do you optimize your cost structures in buying, how do you mitigate forex volatility, particularly when you are operating on developing markets, on your incoming materials, how do you operate with the most optimum manufacturing footprint, neither too centralized nor too fragmented. So, and that is therefore in I would call it in the box of skills or supply chain skills. But that to me comes after the business acumen. If you have the business acumen, you know exactly what skills you should be learning, and one can start picking them up pretty soon. And the third one is it's not just about hiring one person. The person whom you hire should be a catalyst of a role model to bring more people like themselves and to develop more and more people down the line who think and who behave and who have the same superlative skill sets as a new hire in the company would have. And that's about leadership then. So it's about business acumen, it's about functional skills, and it's about your ability to develop a team who can really work with the same level of enterprise and creativity as you want to work.
And I'd love to also pick your brains a little bit in terms of the future, like 5, 10, 20 years down the line, or let's say 5 to 10 years down the line, not to go too far off. And in terms of the skills, functional skills, not the soft skills, but the functional technical skills, because again, technology is changing rapidly, everything. And you mentioned machine learning, you mentioned the tool that you've developed on that side. There's more and more tools being developed in different tech angles of the business. Do you see a shift also in the type of skill sets that people will need to pick up in the supply chain function, you know, on top of, you know, the S&OP, the demand planning, the, you know, the usual, what have been so far? Are there certain blends that you see coming in the next 5 to 10 years, or some other new things that may be coming in, or useful things for people to pick up?
See, I think you already named it. The single biggest transformational mega trend that we are sitting on today is technology. Yeah. I mean, you just have to look back 5 years ago and you have to think that what a stage was e-commerce in at that time. How many products could you order through your smartphone? How many people indeed had smartphones 5 or 10 years ago? And that projects you into the future, is that what will be coming is perhaps something which we cannot completely even comprehend. But we know that it will be in the space of technology. Increasingly, consumers will want personalized products, and we are working on a thought process on that, is that if somebody says that I want a fragrance which should be custom designed by me. I want a little bit more of this kind of notes and a little less of floral notes and so on. Then we should be able to concoct it for her in a bottle design of her choice and a cap of her choice and a decoration of her choice and probably even her name monogrammed on it. Yeah. That manufacturing flexibility, that level of customization is I would foresee if I just look into the future, is something which will become, which will start driving consumer preference. And the technology to enable that is already there in parts. Yeah, it's just that the deployment of that technology hasn't happened on a large scale. Yeah. So the related areas of technology, product personalization are clearly things which I see coming up in the future. The other one which I see is around sustainable products, around this whole thing around plastic packaging, for instance, which is, of course, already a very important driver of preference. And how do we make our planet more sustainable through products which are more sustainable? If you look at the footprint of products of personal care around the world, then I would say around 60% of the impact on the environment comes through the product itself. And the rest is through distribution, manufacturing, or the raw materials and so on. So therefore, how you design your products to be more sustainable, more eco-friendly, whatever, biodegradable, etc., is suddenly becoming a bigger and bigger driver. You can see in food products how it is driving preference. Consumers increasingly want to know where the ingredients in my food product have been sourced from and have they been sourced responsibly. We know about the palm oil debate, for instance. We know about the cocoa debate and so on. And therefore, the whole sustainability proposition in the products is going to become an increasing driver. And that even goes back and links to the technology point which I was making earlier, which is blockchains. Yeah. Where did it originate from? Where did the last ingredient in it originate from? Was it sourced responsibly? And then, you know, blockchains are bringing that visibility more and more to how one operates. You know, in Russia, there is now a new legislation. This is all real and it started happening now, whereby every product needs to carry a QR code, which is unique to not that SKU, but that particular product, that piece, that SKU, that item. It is unique to that, needs to carry a QR code. That QR code is traced through the life journey of that product from the time you make it in a factory and you start sending it outwards. So these are all real trends. So traceability, sustainability, technology linked to it, blockchains is the other theme which is developing in a major way. The third one which I would call out is around what I call the rise of the second tier cities. So increasingly, urbanization of a population coming from rural areas, particularly in the developing markets, be it in Africa and Asia and parts of Latin America, will not be about the London or the Shanghai or the Delhi or Mumbai or Manilas of the world. It is the rise of the second tier cities, which would attract increasing urbanization of customers, consumers who are as digitally savvy, as technologically connected as any of the customers in the mega cities of the world. And therefore, the ability to create distribution models in this second tier cities, which are increasingly coming up in every single country of the world, would be the key driver from a supply chain point of view on how we enable growth. So digital sustainability, the mega trend of suburbanization, if I may call it that, are the ones which are really, to my mind, what I can see 5 to 10 years down the line.
And also I wanted to bring forward another big trend, which has, and I like that throughout the discussion that we've been having, you keep mentioning always her, and obviously it's the key clients that you have and the customers that you have as a company. But at the same time, diversity in general and supporting women and promoting diversity has become a big theme across organizations, across multinationals, and I was also, you know, also across the workforce, obviously. And I was, I wanted to ask you, because I know that you have a couple of projects at, around this at Avon, to ask you to share some of this with us, and maybe also to share how it impacts the company's vision and strategy.
Yeah, so I think, see, first of all, we pride ourselves in being one of the biggest livelihood generators for women around the world. And as I go around the world and I talk to our representatives, I feel very humbled when a representative comes to me and she says, is that, look, she had a problem with her husband and then she was left to bring her three children alone. And because she was an Avon representative, she could get her earnings. And now the three children have gone to school, they have graduated and they are now good citizens. They are earning well. She's built a house and so on and so forth. It's when you're dealing with millions of representatives like that, whose livelihood depends on you, then it is not just about the supply chain and about making sure that you're perfect in a supply chain. Then what hits you is that, look, if in a box there is one item which is missing, then actually what you've done is not just dissatisfied a customer, but actually hit her earnings. Because every product she sells, she gets her earnings out of that. So I think the first and foremost thing in this company is this strong sense of purpose in generating earnings, generating livelihoods for millions of women who work for us around the world. And I think emancipation starts from economic emancipation. And this is what, to my mind, we contribute towards that. Of course, we have a lot of programs. We have programs around women's health. We have programs around women's group and sourcing from women entrepreneurs and so on. But I think the fundamental thing which we do in this company is to be of service to women for earning their own livelihoods and giving them economic emancipation. Now, connected with that in the larger theme of diversity, as you rightly called out, is also a question of how quick and how insightful are we about what women want, about their product preferences, and about the shifting trends, which of course will be very different from a UK to a Philippines to a China, and how do you really cater to those demands? How well are they already served in beauty products, which will be very different from an evolved beauty market like, let's say, Korea, compared to one of the markets in Africa? And how do you really cater to her needs? So it's about understanding the women consumer, and understanding a women consumer, you need more women in the organization to be able to relate to that better. So therefore, to me, how Avon would address the diversity question, or is already addressing, is first of all developing, is first of all generating earnings for millions of women, and second is about investing in our own organization or our reps to make them understand women better. And I think that is also where the role of the Avon Academy comes in, because that is our training centers, and that's where we hope to continue training increasing number of women into being beauty consultants and beauty advisors rather than couriers of beauty products.
That's great, and that's a very good analogy there. Advisors and partners, and basically beauty advisors rather than couriers. It's a great way of putting it. Final question from us, Vikram. What would be the best piece of advice that you would share with somebody that maybe one day wants to achieve what you've achieved in your career, to become a chief supply chain officer? What would be that one piece of advice that stuck with you most and helped you most in your career?
Always keep connected with the business. Think business before you think of the supply chain. Be on the ball absolutely with trends which are developing on technology. Don't be afraid to learn from others. There are enough global fora like yourselves in sharing peer knowledge and learning from what others are doing. And be creative. There is supply chain, you can make it as drab a function as you want it to be, and you can make it as creative as you want it to be. In fact, I love people who people in my team who go to my marketing colleagues and say that, hey, why don't you think of this? I can actually do this for you. Rather than waiting on the sides and then having someone come to me and ask me, can you do this? And then I say yes or no. So be on the front foot, be business connected, be creative, and be completely connected with the developments in the supply chain around the world.
Thank you. Very good advice. And Vikram, thank you for all the sharing, for the good case studies, and for the good examples that you have imparted with us today. And wishing you continued success in the transformation, and you know, many more markets in which you bring the 1 hour delivery available. You make 1 hour delivery available, and all the other challenges that you've set yourself up for. And hopefully we share again in a few years and a few months, and you can tell us how you did it.
Yeah, absolutely. Very glad to be speaking about this, Radu, and look forward to connecting again.
Super. Many thanks.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to follow us on radupalamariu.com/podcast for all the show notes, links, and extra tips covered in the interview. Make sure also to subscribe to our emailing list to get the news in the nick of time. If you're listening through a streaming platform like iTunes or Stitcher and you like what we do, please kindly review and give us 5 stars so we can keep the energy flowing and get more people to find out about our podcast. I'm most active on LinkedIn, so do feel free to follow me to stay tuned for our latest articles as well as future guests for the podcast. And if you have any suggestions or any other idea, please feel free to write to me. I respond to all. And also, please make sure not to miss our next episode, where we will be having a few other C-level and top leaders in supply chain joining us. Stay tuned.